International Film Festival from November 26th to December 12th. For tickets and schedule, go to nyadiff.org or call 212-864-1760. That's 212-864-1760. Enjoy your world on the big screen. The previous program was The Minefield, heard Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico. This is still WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online.
This is Randy Credico live on the fly with a special Assange Countdown to Freedom, which will be played on various channels and websites and radio stations. So we're not going to identify them right here, except for to say we have a very special show today as we go into the holidays. This is actually being recorded on the anniversary of the assassination of John F. Kennedy, which I just now realized. And we're going to have ladies first. We have, we're introducing wise, Colleen Rowley, who's been on this show several times. She is a whistleblower, former FBI special agent and a counsel, and she's a recipient of the prestigious Sam Adams Award. John Kiriakou, whose books, he's written about 10 books, also a whistleblower, a recipient. I think Craig Murray gave him the award in 2016, the Sam Adams Award. And John is going off to Germany to present a book about whistleblowers. And certainly last but not least, someone that we all admire and respect. And you know, he Daniel Ellsberg has been so gracious and so generous with his time. But there was a 5-year lapse where I was afraid to ask him because I know how busy he is to do this show. I've done about 200 Assange shows. But he's joining us again from Berkeley, California. And John, let's start off because we're kind of free forming this.
You bet.
How important is Daniel Ellsberg to this movement? To free Assange.
I don't want to embarrass Dan, of course, but I'll repeat what I've said publicly. Dan is the godfather of modern day national security whistleblowing. If Dan hadn't done what he did with the Pentagon Papers, none of us would have been able to do what we did later. And the parallels between what Dan did so long ago now, 50 years ago, and what Julian did are striking. Listen, Julian's a smart guy. Julian knows history. He's studied history. He knew about Dan and Dan's heroic actions by releasing the Pentagon Papers. I know that Dan was a source of inspiration for Julian, just like he was a source of inspiration for all the rest of us. I'm honored to know him. You know, I still name drop Dan with my friends. Like, I know Dan Ellsberg and I consider him to be a friend. You know, I still can't believe that I'm friends with Dan Ellsberg. It means so much to me. People understand that. They realize that because now they have a real appreciation for what he did. Dan knew what the consequences were. And he did it anyway, because it was the right thing to do. And that has inspired so many more people to do the right thing, the least of which is certainly not Julian Assange.
Colleen, as well, you've known Dan says you guys are friends. Has he been an inspiration to a lot of people, including yourself?
Well, yes, of course. The one thing that I find very unusual, and sadly unusual, about Daniel Ellsberg is he's a survivor. You know, whistleblowing is such a traumatic and risky and in some ways soul, you know, wrenching situation, especially if you lose even your own family and friends, et cetera, that, you know, he's one of the very few who not only survived that experience and actually was able to turn it into something good and use it, but also he's the Duracell battery.
Yeah.
And he's never looked back, and it's just been straightforward. I think Julian Assange, you know, it's so difficult for him now in prison this way, but I think he has similar strength of character as Daniel Ellsberg. And maybe, you know, we could even say people like Mandela, you know, who actually did go through that kind of a prison experience and were able to come out of it. And so, I mean, we have to cross our fingers right now, but obviously this is what we're aiming for. We're aiming for surviving truth telling and then continuing on. And it's never been so difficult as it is in the present time.
Well, Dan, let me ask you this. You've inspired so many whistleblowers, Ed Snowden, John, Colleen, Julian. Who inspired you when you went forward? I know there was an anti-war activist who has the same name, Randy Keller, I believe, that inspired you to go forward. But what prior to that was it that subconsciously drove you to actually do it?
Well, listen, let me back off there for one moment, because I didn't expect, and it's not clear to me why we're starting this off with such gratifying praise for my friends here. But the funny thing is, as I'm looking at this screen, I'm looking at two people that I was talking about this morning. I had a two-hour Zoom meeting with a class at UMass Amherst run by Professor Chris Appy. And in the course of that, I had time enough to talk about heroes of mine here, but I in two contexts. One, that the example that the question arises as to when you should not only be a whistleblower, but when you it is simply wrong to prosecute a whistleblower. The most obvious case would be when you're revealing criminality in the sense that no parliament, no executive branch, no court can make it legal. Torture cannot be made legal. And then you can argue about what is torture, but then there's lots of things that are really beyond argument, and that's what the U.S. was doing in this case. And I said, how many people, hundreds at least, 1,000 more, John would know better, were aware that what we were doing was criminal, not only in international law, but in our Constitution and in domestic law, that there was no way to make it legal? And of all the hundreds of people who knew that we were doing that, one, to my knowledge, went to prison. And that was the one who revealed, inadvertently or otherwise, revealed the name of a torturer, a covert actor. As I understand it, he was not aware that the person's status at that time was still protected. But anyway, he was charged with doing that and went to prison, having in fact revealed somebody in the torture program, and having earlier described the waterboarding as torture, for which I think the CIA will never forgive him, as he probably says. No. Just as they will never forgive Snowden, they will never forgive Chelsea Manning for revealing that we were turning people over to torture in Iraq under Obama, knowing there was for torture, which is as illegal as doing the torture ourselves. And so she spent 7.5 years in prison. So anyway, I was describing John in those terms as having been dealt with very, very badly by his country and by his former agency, but in general, constitutionally, by the president, by everybody, and in a way that should not happen in this country. But I was also mentioning Colleen, as you, who is, I said, the word whistleblower was pretty much legitimized for the first time by a Time cover with Persons of the Year. That was not me. Whistleblowers, Colleen Rowley's face on that cover.
And right here. This,
yeah. Oh, really? Okay. Well, just between us, not to derogate or anyway, the two other women who were there, very technically, as I read their account for Enron, I think, another one, I'm not sure I would call them whistleblowers. They were truth tellers, but correct me if I'm wrong, Colleen. My understanding is that they told the truth to their bosses and not to outside the agency, the corporation, which about which was giving incriminating information. Again, tell me if I'm wrong, but I think the other two acted admirably within their organization, did not take the step of risking their careers, being ostracized, being possibly even prosecuted, by going outside that organization to hold it accountably. And Colleen did do that. And as I understand it, not to go into it too much, I think she experienced the kind of, not entirely, but ostracism within her own organization, the FBI, that every truth teller who is revealing wrongdoing by her or his own group is risking ostracism, and most people will not take that risk. So, again, as I say, I'm looking at two people who very much do exemplify, I would say, the best in America, the possibility of American citizenship, which is too little observed.
Thank you for that, Dan. That means a lot to me. You know, one of the things that Dan taught me early on was that there's a greater good. There's a greater good with whistleblowing. One of the things that I learned from a recent study on whistleblowers is that whistleblowers have a much more highly defined sense of right and wrong than the general population. This is something borne out in psychological studies. And so when a whistleblower is considering blowing the whistle on waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, or threats to the public health or public safety, he or she takes into consideration that greater good. And, you know, eventually history is going to catch up with the issue and with everybody else. You may be vilified the way Dan was vilified, the way Julian Assange is being vilified right now. But eventually, the rest of the world will catch up. We've seen this happen throughout history. And I think that's one of the reasons why Julian has been so steadfast in his belief that he did the right thing. God knows the cost has been high. We see what the poor man is undergoing. Nils Melzer has said repeatedly, Nils Melzer, the UN Special Rapporteur on torture, has said repeatedly that what Julian has been experiencing is a form of torture. We all know that the way the United States practices solitary confinement is a form of torture. We know that these CMUs, these communications management units that we have in our medium and maximum security prisons is a form of torture. But the government doesn't yet have an appreciation for the fact that none of that matters. Julian is tougher than everybody gives him credit for being, just like Dan was tougher than everybody gave him credit for being. You know, Dan stood up to a president, arguably one of the most powerful and corrupt presidents in modern American history. Julian has stood up to, what, three different presidents so far. So there's this odd way that people have a tendency to underestimate our resolve. And they do that, I think, Randy, at their own peril.
Colleen, jump in there. I'm a fly on the wall on this one.
Well, you know, I think in any whistleblower's trajectory, if you want to call it that, from start to finish, a lot of times it begins with a certain amount of naivety, where people are honestly believe so much in that there is right and wrong, and that it's really hard to believe that you can be in these situations like Orwell. You know, I think Orwell has a quote where you become a traitor telling the truth in an empire of lies. And I mean, that's really, really, I think, a telling thing right now, the empire of lies, and you're a traitor to tell the truth. But, you know, it's hard to think that at the start. You don't think that just outing torture, for heaven's sakes, you know, everybody would think, okay, if you're torturing, that's right, you know, very wrong. And you can't believe that you can be the one that's later smeared for being the one who told the truth about torture or other war crimes. It's hard to believe that. You know, I know we're going to talk a little bit about the Assange case and a little bit about the FBI's informant
program. Yes, we're going to do that in the second half here.
But I'm just going to jump a little bit ahead, because one of the things that, you know, as the trajectory goes on, long before 9/11 and all of this started, long before that, after a lot of years in the FBI, I started to see, oh my gosh, look what they're doing with these informants. They're operating murderers in some cases. You know, and again, you don't think that, you think, okay, everybody's going to want to stop this. As soon as we know that the FBI is operating murderers, that will end, because nobody will be for that. And that's where, again, this kind of this trajectory, the scales come off your eyes. And that's a real sad experience, to find out that people are so easily misled on knowing right from wrong. Going back to what you say, it's really a depressing thing to see how many other people can't stick to principles and can't stick to, you know, what's right and what's wrong in really horrible situations like an empire of lies, which is Orwell's term, but I think it's very fitting.
Yes. We're talking with Colleen Riley, John Kiriakou, and Mr. Daniel Ellsberg. Dan, always say call you Dan. Dan, I'm going to ask everybody a stupid question. I'll start with you, Dan. Does anybody have any regrets for coming forward, Dan?
I haven't met a whistleblower, and I've sought out many of them, including both of you. I've sought them out because I identify with them so much, and I know what they've gone through. I've been through that same trajectory, which, remember, always is for us a trajectory, because we got access to that information by having been loyal servants of the cause of the organization up till then, or we wouldn't have gotten that access. And so then, as Colleen says, the scales fall from your eyes at some point. They fall from a lot more eyes than people, those people who know what's, who actually speak out. Because it's one thing not to know it, as I've learned, and we've all seen in the last year, especially, anyone can believe anything, and anyone can deny anything, practically. I mean, look at what we're seeing in the country. It's rather staggering to some extent. But we all started out believing, and a number of other people with us, I'm sure, at least in the cases I know, Snowden, for example, know that other colleagues knew just as much, just as well as Snowden's colleagues said, this is wrong. You know, we're listening to everyone, everything, and this is wrong. But what would they do about it? And as is always the case, I have children in college. I have a mortgage on my house. We're all settled here in this community. I just can't afford to break with all of that. And that's understandable to a large extent, and the price generally is high. I am one of the few, as I think Colleen referred to, lucky one, that I am one of the few who, in effect, got away with it by virtually a miracle of a convergence of circumstances that led to revelation of criminality by the president, which actually led to dismissal of my case. But very unusual. Nixon wanted to put me in prison for 115 years, but didn't get it. Assange is facing 175 years, which would come to much the same thing if they got us in. But he is in prison now, being held at this point. Snowden, permanent exile. John was a 30 months, something like that, in prison. Huh? And Chelsea Manning, 7.5 years. Daniel Hale right now.
45 months.
Ritter. Is that it? Yeah. Mm-hmm. I was referring to him this morning, too, to these students. The students today don't know his predecessor. Spacing of, I'm, you know, his predecessor is Nathan Hale. And yes. It turned out I asked for how many people in that class knew the name. I grew up with it, of course, and they don't. But I think of myself, or I have said, this was his, Nathan Hale, Daniel Hale's actual ancestor. And he was the first person prosecuted for giving information to Americans, true information. On the second, it turns out, I am proud of that that heritage here. He was hanged by the British for being a spy for Washington and for a country that didn't actually yet exist in a recognized form. What he was famous for, as we all, as you and we know, saying as he was about to be hanged, I regret that I have but one life to give for my country. And what country was that? Colin was saying it was a country founded by traitors like Nathan Hale and Washington and every signer of the Declaration of Independence, who were all liable, like Nathan Hale, to be hanged as traitors, and several of them were traitors to George III. Of whom they had been loyal subjects just 2 years earlier, or 3 years earlier. And they found a new loyalty to a country that, let's put it this way, that doesn't have an official Secrets Act officially, that doesn't make a traitor of someone who criticizes the leader, the monarch, the government. That's our country, supposedly. So it would be good if they know this history more. You asked me, Randy, who inspired me, and I was thinking as I heard these wonderful tributes, John was saying we are inspired by, I was looking and said, I've never heard from Colleen that she had me in mind, and I don't know it yet exactly either. I was told by a biographer of Julian that he had been inspired by me. And I said, how could that be? I happened to know when he was born. It was a week, when he was born, a week after my wife and I had spent 13 days eluding the FBI, successfully, by the way. I don't know how you feel about that, Colleen, about your old organization, but at one point, having eluded them for 13 days, I asked my lawyer, Leonard Boudin, what is the FBI actually good at? And he said, taking surrenders, which I did after 13 days. But the point was that Julian had been born just after that, so how could I have inspired him? And the biographer said his mother was an anti-Vietnam War activist in Australia, and she in Australia had told him stories of the anti-war movement in this country, including my name. So that was very gratifying to hear that it had been like that. In my case, there was, in addition to Randy Keeler, who was, as I've often told the story, announced that he was going to prison, and that struck me very, very hard because I hadn't known he was on his way to prison, but and confronted me with the question, all right, what can I do to help end this war now that I'm ready to go to prison like him? But just 2 days earlier, another young man named Bob Eaton was being sentenced for draft resistance, nonviolent draft resistance, and I had stood in a vigil line at this conference. And I think John and Colleen will appreciate, at that conference of the War Resisters League, I was reluctant to go to that vigil because I was still working at RAND, and I thought, if my picture is in front of the Philadelphia courthouse here, standing in a line, it not only people will think I've gone mad, they will think, what? A man who had access to these higher-ups, you know, and could give them advice, and access to, is what could be less dignified than standing on a hot afternoon in front of the courthouse handing out leaflets? But the change that made in my life was, well, I was about to say, I didn't really want to go to that. But I thought of saying that I was sick or something. And then I thought, well, the conference is still going on. They'll see that I'm not sick. So I had to go. And then I found in the course of it that I wasn't made of sugar after all. I wasn't dissolving at this indignity. And I started handing out leaflets to people in the court. And that actually changed my life. That was before Randy Itaway, because it was like when you step over a line in the recruiting office, and that, you know, the Marines, as I had done, you step over the line, and for the rest of your career, you're told, you stepped over that line, you know, don't complain, don't, whatever happens, you volunteered. Well, in standing in a vigil for Bob Eaton, I was stepping over a line. I was joining a movement.
Dan, we have to take a quick break here. And for those listening in New York City, you can hear all of this on Assange Countdown to Freedom or next Monday on a different network. And we'll be right back after a quick musical break.
For WPFW Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Askia Muhammad. Here are some headlines. This is breaking news. A jury in Georgia has reached a verdict in the trial of three men accused of chasing down and killing Ahmaud Arbery, a young black man, as he jogged through their neighborhood in February 2020. Travis McMichael, his father Gregory McMichael, and neighbor William Roddy Bryan Jr. each faced 9 separate charges. Travis McMichael was found guilty on all charges, including malice murder, felony murder, aggravated assault, false imprisonment, and criminal attempt to commit a felony. Greg McMichaels was found not guilty on the charge of malice murder, but guilty of all other counts, including felony murder. Roddy McDowell was found not guilty of malice, but guilty of felony murder. The decisions were read to the court moments ago. Earlier today, jurors asked to review video of the deadly encounter between Arbery and the men charged with murder and his killing. The 2 days of deliberations came after 8 days of testimony and 23 witnesses. A federal jury in Cleveland on Tuesday found that the companies owning CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart pharmacies are liable for contributing to the opioid epidemic in 2 Ohio counties. During the trial, attorneys for Lake and Trumbull counties blamed the 3 chain pharmacies for failing to stop a flood of pills that caused hundreds of overdose deaths and cost each of the 2 counties about $1 billion in law enforcement, social services, and court expenses. The civil case marks the first time pharmacies have been found responsible in the nationwide epidemic. After hearings in the spring, the trial judge will determine how much each company should pay the counties. CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart said they would appeal the verdict. The number of Americans applying for unemployment benefits plummeted last week to the lowest level in more than half a century. Another sign that the U.S. job market is rebounding rapidly from last year's coronavirus recession. Jobless claims dropped by 71,000 to 199,000, the lowest since mid-November 1969.